loses its bite and the enchantment becomes fantasy and, finally, nostalgia. This is why it endures. Cyberpunk is a false future, a future of the past. In its playground, we are free to be reckless and selfish and short-sighted and lost. We are free not to care, not to fight, not to matter. There may be cyberspace in cyberpunk, but there's no social media. There may be surveillance, but there's resistance to it. Who could have guessed in the 1980s that we would choose to surveil ourselves, that we would happily give up every crumb of personal information for packages delivered a few days sooner and tailored search results? Cyberpunk offers a nostalgic escape from what is dystopic in our present, not by appealing to some idealized past, but by imagining an alternate timeline in which those things never came to pass. Set in 2019, Blade Runner is no longer the future. It's now, another now. I wouldn't choose it over ours, but that only amplifies its appeal. When experts disagree. The world is crowded with people who are certain. You see them on the news, at the pulpit. You hear them at dinner parties and neighborhood cafes. These people know, or act like they do. They know the answers to the most difficult questions. They know the actions that need to be taken. They know why the wrong choices are wrong and the right choices are right. And in private, maybe they doubt, but in public, they're sure. Sure, this candidate should be elected and this advice should be heeded. And if only you did this, then that would happen without question. At times, I am one of these people. I'm guilty of telling friends what they should do, even when I don't have all the info. Even when I have all the info, but the situation is too complex for any one solution to be as right as I'm making it seem. It's usually better to talk less and listen more. And if I don't always take that advice in personal matters, in political ones I have, to the point of radio silence, especially in the last few years. The biggest reason for that is my job. As my audience has grown at The Nerdwriter, I felt more and more responsible for being right and more fearful of being wrong. With complicated issues, the risk often seems too great, so I opt for making videos about subjects that invite varied interpretation, like works of art. My analysis of a painting or film is not right with a capital R. It's just one reading among many. And if my take on Blade Runner or Goya's Saturn devouring his son helps you appreciate the work in a new way, if it helps you see those masterpieces from a different angle, I'm satisfied. On issues that require true expertise, that do have a right answer, I've become much more cautious. This responsibility, that fear, forced me to reevaluate my beliefs. As a result, some of my opinions were reinforced, while others were challenged and had to be changed. It always feels good to learn that you're right, and it's never easy to admit you're wrong, but in both cases, at least you arrive at an answer. What's more upsetting than either of these is a dead end, and it's these dead ends I want to explore in this essay. They can be summed up in a question that's haunted me for a long time. When experts disagree, how do I decide? When those who have spent their entire working lives trying to understand an issue cannot find consensus, how does the layperson determine what is right? Debates rage in every discipline, from philosophy to physics to art to planktology. In subjective fields, experts can be helpful, but they're not necessary to establish what's good and bad. As I suggested before, there are no right answers in art criticism, just opinions, some more insightful than others, but even the most insightful aren't binding. We can all decide for ourselves what has artistic value. In highly specialized fields, on the other hand, like astrophysics, expertise is a precondition for comment. I could give my view on why there are discrepancies in the Hubble constant, but that view is unlikely to have any impact on working astrophysicists. Fortunately for science, I'm not responsible for making judgments on esoteric debates like this, nor is any layperson. It's not art or astrophysics that keeps me up at night. It's politics. All the esoteric debates that fall under its umbrella actually are my responsibility. Representative democracies ask citizens to weigh in on extremely complex issues by choosing politicians who will enact policies that might affect thousands, millions, even hundreds of millions of people. To vote is to come down on one side of a debate. We can outsource some of the strategy to our representatives, but we are the final authority. On huge questions of economics, health, war, and justice, the buck stops with me, with you. If this is the system we want, that's the responsibility we have. No pressure. Obviously, it's impossible for any one person to become an expert on every subject about which they're asked to vote. Even if I filtered issues through the narrowest self-interest, I would still have plenty of difficulty making choices. Do I favor or oppose the authorization for use of military force, for example, which allows the president to undertake war against Al-Qaeda and its affiliates without congressional approval? Is that authorization good or bad for me? The powers it grants could enable the president to act with the speed necessary to stop a terror attack that could hurt me or someone I love. On the flip side, those powers could be used to justify engagement in conflicts I oppose, putting a service member friend in harm's way, or depleting so much of the federal budget that programs I need go underfunded. At first glance, after many glances, I find it unclear which position benefits me most. It's even less clear which position benefits everyone most. All I really know is that I'm unqualified to choose. So I research, I learn, I turn to the experts. In the modern era, knowledge has become so vast and specialized that a lifetime of study won't scratch the surface. Informed citizens have no choice but to depend on the expertise of others, and the essential skill in today's world is not so much learning as filtering, sifting through those who claim to be knowledgeable about a subject, then choosing whom to believe. We expend our critical thinking on reputation as much as information. Where is this data coming from? What are the credentials of this person or group? Do they have an agenda? What have colleagues said about them? Do people you trust this person, this organization, this theory, this finding? Do a majority of people in the field believe this to be true? An overwhelming majority? Why does the minority disagree? Broad knowledge in a specialized world can only be achieved by means of trust. After all, what do I really know about climate change? If I'm honest with myself, I have to admit that my support for policies to fight climate change rests on the fact that basically all scientists believe it to be real, dangerous, driven by human activity, and capable of being mitigated. I learned that from science educators, who are essential links between experts and laypeople. That's a couple degrees of separation from figures and experiments. I couldn't tell you anything about those experiments or how they yield the data that make all those troubling graphs. I probably shouldn't source my climate knowledge solely from John Oliver, who told me on Last Week Tonight that a survey of thousands of scientific papers that took a position on climate change found that 97% endorsed the position that humans are causing global warming. But how far down does my responsibility go? A few layers more, at least. The survey Oliver mentioned, quantifying the consensus on anthropogenic global warming in the scientific literature, comes from Environmental Research Letters, a quarterly, peer-reviewed, open-access scientific journal covering all aspects of environmental science. It's one of many academic journals published by the Institute of Physics, a 145-year-old scientific charity that works to advance physics education, research, and application. Trying to get a sense of the bona fides of these groups, I came across the concept of impact factors, a metric used to calculate the credibility and significance of academic journals. Environmental Research Letters has an impact factor of 6.192, according to the 2019 Journal Citation Reports, a widely cited publication by Clarivate Analytics, putting it in the top tier of environmental science journals. Okay, the source is legit. What does the study say? The survey analyzed 11,944 climate abstracts from peer-reviewed papers that matched search results of global warming or global climate change, and it covered a 21-year period from 1991 to 2012. Independent researchers were randomly assigned the abstracts and asked to rate them categorically, the aspect of climate science involved, and by degree of endorsement of the idea that climate change is real and caused by humans. Each abstract was rated independently by two researchers. If there was a disagreement, they compared opinions and justified their choices. If they still disagreed, a third party was brought in to make the final call. The authors consolidated the results into three categories: endorsement, no position, and rejection. Of the 11,944 abstracts, 32.6% endorsed the idea of man-made global warming. 66.4% offered no position. 0.7% rejected the idea, and 0.3% expressed uncertainty. So where does the 97% come from? The authors don't say that 97% of all abstracts endorse the position that humans are causing global warming, but 97% of those expressing an opinion. To get that figure, they put aside the 66.4% of papers that offered no position, calculating that 97.1% of the remaining papers maintain climate change is real and caused by us. Does this mean the 66.4% of abstracts expressing no opinion are still on the fence? The authors anticipated this question and reached out to these scientists personally. The majority of those who responded believe their paper did in fact endorse man-made climate change. Only 1.8% of self-raters said their work rejected that idea, mirroring the initial findings. Additionally, the authors explained that a large percentage of no position papers is consistent with consensus situations where the fundamental science is no longer controversial among the publishing science community and the remaining debate in the field has moved on to other topics. This survey is the most read entry in the history of Environmental Research Letters, downloaded over 1 million times. After 2 more days of researching, I couldn't find any paper from an equally reputable journal that refuted its core findings. The closest thing to a challenge I discovered was a reply by Richard Toll, also published in Environmental Research Letters, which argued that faults in the survey's methodology overestimated the consensus, but did not dispute the idea of man-made climate change. If you accounted for these mistakes, Toll suggests, the consensus value would be closer to 91%. The original authors rebutted this rebuttal, defending their methods. In another reply, geologist James Powell also debated the methodology but found the opposite result. According to his reading of the abstracts, 99.9% of climate scientists agree with man-made global warming, verging on unanimity. The original authors rebutted this rebuttal, too. When a consensus is this overwhelming, do you have a responsibility to seek out the vanishingly small number of dissenting opinions? It's important to be sensitive to your own biases and to recognize that those biases can manifest in subtle ways, in how you phrase a Google search, for example. But I believe there's a point at which additional research is unnecessary. We're taught to weigh all sides of a debate. But when does a debate stop being a debate? Could any layperson really say that data from the survey's 118 contrarian climate papers outweigh the consensus in 3,896 others? Later in that Last Week Tonight segment, Oliver describes the irresponsible ways man-made climate change is presented as debatable. When the debate is covered on television, he says, it's always one person for, one person against. When you look at the screen, it's 50-50, which is inherently misleading. If there has to be a debate about the reality of climate change, and there doesn't, then there is only one mathematically fair way to do it. He then stages a statistically representative climate change debate, pitting three climate change deniers against Bill Nye and 96 other scientists. I'm convinced. A combination of research and common sense tells me that global warming is real and is caused by human activity. Whether it's dangerous, exactly how dangerous, and how much we can mitigate the effects at this point are separate questions. Following the standards I used above, I found that the harms of climate change are significant and will worsen over time. I'm also convinced there are steps we could take to alleviate those harms, though not completely, and that inaction will be very damaging. I'm not detailing my research on these questions in the same way I detailed the survey above, but you can check my sources in the Works Cited section, included as a PDF with this audiobook. Or you could just trust me. You could trust my trust, that is. I still know very little about the fieldwork of climatologists, the data science involved, or the predictive models they use. My knowledge of climate history is basic, as is my knowledge of weather patterns, polar ice caps, academic publishing, peer review, and so much more. I also don't know what I don't know, which I'm sure in a field this technical includes a lot. I've delved a few layers deeper than John Oliver, but there's more below me than above. My political position on climate change, in other words, is built on a scaffolding of trust. Admitting this, it's easy to see how climate change skepticism might be persuasive to some. According to a Washington Post and Kaiser Family Foundation poll from 2019, 20% of Americans do not believe human activity is causing the climate to change. Why do 20% of Americans side with fewer than 3% of scientists? Footnote: public opinion is moving fast on this issue. A Pew Research Center poll from back in 2016 found that half of Americans did not think human activity was driving climate change. A 30-point shift in 3 years is extraordinary. Politicization is one cause. Democrats are 30 percentage points more likely to believe humans are causing climate change, according to the same WAPO-Kaiser poll. As one party makes climate policy more central to their platform, it makes sense that the other party would grow resistant to it. But there's a more fundamental reason for climate change skepticism: the anxiety of knowing how little we actually know. For all their accredited institutions, their rigorous processes and impact factors, scientists are essentially saying, trust us. There is an unshakable feeling of vulnerability that comes with trust like that, in which a mass of knowledge is outsourced and remains obscure. The layperson can't confidently defend against challenges to the information contained within their trust, and that makes them susceptible to alternative theories, especially those that are equally technicalized. When faced with models and graphs claiming to show that climate change is not real or not as bad as we think or not caused by humans, the best response I have is an appeal to my trust in the experts, in the consensus. Bad faith actors exploit these insecurities. Those who stand to lose from action on climate change have marshaled considerable resources to hit us where we're vulnerable. They bankroll studies that dispute the consensus. They blitz the media with experts who question the findings, methods, and integrity of scientists. They donate heavily to politicians who lend credence to these dissenting narratives. There is a lot of power behind disinformation campaigns like this, a lot of money. But I don't think either would find a foothold if there weren't some lingering confusion in the minds of their targets. Fortunately, this attempt to muddy the discourse seems to be losing steam. As the latest polling shows, the public is rapidly approaching the same consensus as the experts. But climate change is an easy case. Not easy to solve, as our failure to take sufficient action proves again and again, but easy to judge. Earlier, I asked, when experts disagree, how do I decide? In the case of climate change, the experts do not disagree. They're virtually all on the same page regarding the basic facts, so it's easy for me to be on that page too and feel confident I've judged the issue correctly. Exactly where the issue falls in a list of priorities is up to every voter, but it's refreshing to have a clear sense of which direction to push. Such a settled debate is, unfortunately, rare in politics. Many other problems voters are asked to solve do not enjoy consensus among experts. What then? Take the minimum wage. There is an ongoing debate, which seems to be nearing its climax as I write this, about whether to raise the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour from its current $7.25 an hour. Democrats have made this increase a core plank of their party platform. Every major candidate for the Democratic nomination for president in 2020, except Andrew Yang, favored a $15 minimum wage. For several, it was a central campaign promise. In July 2019, the Democrat-led House of Representatives passed a bill to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, signaling the party's political will on the issue. The bill promptly died in the Republican-led Senate, where it was not brought up for a vote. On this issue, Democrats align with a majority of voters. According to 2019 polling from Pew, 67% of Americans support raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour, including 41% who say they strongly favor such an increase. The numbers are even more lopsided among Democrats and left-leaning independents. 86% support the increase. Politicians looking for Democratic votes know which side of this debate to be on. But what's the right thing to do? What do the experts say? Economics is the field that gives me the most uneasiness as a voter. That's not only because economies are vast and incredibly intricate, not only because my knowledge of their dynamics is tiny compared to all there is to know, not only because economic policies have huge impacts on people's lives, but because the economists themselves, the experts, have deep disagreements that I'm asked to adjudicate. On many questions, there is no consensus to find, no overwhelming majority in which to place my trust. For a layperson, that can be a dizzying feeling and a hard one to face. It has been for me. It's why people often start with the conclusion of their tribe and work backward to gather evidence for it, instead of starting with the evidence and using it to justify a conclusion. Sometimes that seems like the only way out of an impossible question. Even if I wanted to construct a position the hard way, the ideological fracturing of the internet makes the backward approach more likely. When I click on Vox's article, "The Debate About the Minimum Wage Explained," aren't I already entering a particular worldview with assumptions that aren't necessarily shared by all reputable economists? AllSides.com, a website that rates the bias of online media organizations, labels Vox as left on a spectrum of left, lean left, center, lean right, right. There's no way to be exact with ratings like this, but AllSides' methodology, which draws on analyses from people across the political spectrum, seems thorough and legitimate. Another analysis from Ad Fontes Media finds bias in Vox content that skews left. As a frequent reader of Vox, I broadly agree with these assessments. Vox promises to explain the news, but I rarely see explainers on the benefits of right-wing ideas. This is probably because Vox explains and advocates for positions they believe to be evidently true and do not seek balance for the sake of it. Bias doesn't necessarily mean wrong, of course. And I find most of the journalism on Vox to be reliable and insightful. Yet, I can't remember the last thing I read from them that really challenged my worldview, which also skews left. That said, the article in question, "The Debate About the Minimum Wage Explained" by Dylan Matthews, offers a good overview of the current research and disagreement in minimum wage studies. There may be some bias baked in, but I'm aware of it and on guard. And whether or not it's the best place to start, it's the place I did start in a good faith attempt to understand the issue. It's what Google served me when I searched, "Should the United States raise the minimum wage to $15? When debating the merits of raising the minimum wage, the key question is whether or not it will cost jobs. As Matthews notes, a basic rule of economics is that setting price floors on milk, oil, or labor causes supply to exceed demand. The critics of a minimum wage increase fear that employers will hire fewer people because they cost more money, or will reduce the hours of their existing employees for the same reason. They fear this lack of hiring and reduction in hours will outweigh the benefits of paying some workers higher wages. The Vox article focuses on a 2019 study by economist Arindrajit Dubey that found this fear largely unwarranted. The study was commissioned by the Conservative government of the United Kingdom, but was independently conducted by Dubey, a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. The upshot from Dubey's report was this. Overall, the most up-to-date body of research from US, UK, and other developed countries points to a very muted effect of minimum wages on employment, while significantly increasing the earnings of low-paid workers. In fact, the overall evidence base suggests an employment impact of close to zero. Because this was a report for the UK, Dubey naturally focused on that country's national living wage, but he drew heavily from international research too, including 36 estimates of minimum wage impact from the United States. Most minimum wage research comes from the United States, Dubey noted, because among developed countries, the U.S. is somewhat unique in having a tremendous amount of variation in the effective minimum wages across localities, especially in recent years. This is due to the fact that the federal minimum wage has remained flat in the last few decades when adjusted for inflation. So several states and cities have taken matters into their own hands and exceeded the national standard. As a result, economists now have multiple examples of adjacent states and counties with different wage floors, ideal scenarios to study the consequences. Dubey summarized the most recent U.S. research in Chapter 4 of his report, citing another 2019 study he was involved in. The upshot of that study is the same as the first. The recent enactment of high minimum wages in U.S. states have been absorbed with little loss in employment to date. Even in states that have raised their minimum wages substantially, like California, Oregon, Washington, Colorado, Massachusetts, New York, and Maine, most of which are on a path to reach $12 or $15 an hour in the next few years. In other words, Dubé believes that the greatest fear of proposed minimum wage hikes, that there will be significant negative employment effects, is not supported by the evidence. Does this mean that Dubé supports increasing the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour? Not exactly. Like any good economist, he knows there's some level at which a minimum wage will have negative effects. What's important to Dubé is finding the limit at which there is a benefit to low-wage workers, but minimal to no harmful effects to employment. Based on his research, Dubé believes that employment effects are small, up to around 59% of the median wage, a number that varies widely across the United States. As of May 2020, the median hourly wage in San Francisco, Oakland, Hayward was $39.35. 59% of that is $23.22. In the state of Alabama, the median was only $17.43. 59% of that is $10.28. Implementing a $15 an hour minimum wage in Alabama would be setting it at 86% of the median, far beyond Dubé's safe limit. This suggests that an across-the-board hike to $15 an hour could potentially prove harmful in some states. To address this issue, Dubé proposes a more tailored approach for state and local governments. Set minimum wages to 50% of the local area median wage while factoring in the local prices of goods. After that, he would index minimum wages to inflation, protecting against real declines in the wage floor. This approach avoids some of the risks associated with a blanket hike at the federal level. Though he may not be fully on board with the fight for 15, Dubé is an expert who wholeheartedly supports the minimum wage as a tool in the fight against poverty. I find robust evidence that higher minimum wages lead to increases in incomes among families at the bottom of the income distribution, and that these wages reduce the poverty rate. He believes that thoughtfully set minimum wages, increased over time, are a net benefit to the economy, and that a federal increase is long overdue. Dubé shares these sentiments with many other experts in the field, some of whom supported the congressional bill passed in 2019, which would have raised the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour by 2024. One of his colleagues, Michael Reich, a professor of economics at UC Berkeley, testified his endorsement of the bill to the House Education and Labor Committee. A $15 minimum wage will generate a substantial economic stimulus because of the increased purchasing power for consumption. Reich went on to list some of the beneficial downstream effects he believed would result from the House bill, based on recent studies of minimum wage increases. They reduce child neglect and poverty and improve child educational outcomes. They also reduce adult smoking rates, absenteeism from work for health reasons, and obesity. Dubé and Reich don't speak for every economist on this issue, but they're far from outliers. They hold distinguished positions at prestigious institutions, and they've published work in reputable journals cited by numerous colleagues. The same could be said for scores of economists who hold similar positions on this issue. Taken together, these experts represent an impressive amount of agreement about the positive effects of raising the minimum wage. Agreement, but not consensus. While low wages contribute to the dire economic straits of many poor and low-income families, the argument that a higher minimum wage is an effective way to improve their economic circumstances is simply not supported by the evidence. That's from a 2018 paper by David Newmark, a professor of economics at UC Irvine. Newmark's work reflects a competing strain in minimum wage studies that paints a more pessimistic picture of these policies. In 2007, Newmark published a paper with William Washer that found what critics of the minimum wage fear. Among the papers we view as providing the most credible evidence, almost all point to negative employment effects. According to their review of the literature, raising the minimum wage does cost jobs. Even worse, Newmark and Washer find relatively overwhelming evidence that the disemployment effects are felt most strongly in the least skilled groups. The group that's supposed to be helped the most, they find, is actually hurt the worst. It's been a while since 2007, but Newmark doesn't find the more recent work by Dubé and his colleagues persuasive. In a 2014 response to a 2010 study by Dubé, Newmark questioned his colleagues' methodology. The methods advocated in these studies, Newmark wrote, do not isolate more reliable identifying information and thus are flawed and lead to incorrect conclusions. Both sides have the same data, but they disagree on how to read it. As I said before, economies are extraordinarily complex. Everything influences everything else. Isolating the effects of one factor, like the minimum wage, is devilishly hard. It makes sense that there would be debates on how best to do this. It makes sense that so many papers focus on what the other side failed to consider. Like Dubé and Reich, Newmark and his sympathetic colleagues hold distinguished positions at prestigious institutions, and they've published work in reputable journals, which is cited by their peers. It's clear that these disagreements are in good faith. Both sides are looking for the truth. They may advocate their positions with more confidence than is warranted, but that's what I expect from professionals presenting their life's work. I don't believe any of these experts have corrupt motives. This doesn't mean there aren't any bad actors. The official-sounding Employment Policies Institute, for instance, publishes droves of material cataloging the supposed harms of raising the minimum wage. In researching this issue, I came across their work more than once, cited by those who oppose increases of any kind. After some digging, however, I discovered the EPI is owned by Berman & Company, a public relations firm that also represents the restaurant industry, which would be negatively affected by increases in the minimum wage. Their surveys, studies, and op-eds have the gloss of respectability, but the operation is tainted. According to the New York Times, Berman & Company bills the EPI for services its employees provide, effectively passing the donor money into the PR firm's coffers. The EPI runs minimumwage.com, too, a polished website devoted to, quote, facts and analysis. Beware. To be sure, the other side of the debate has its own moneyed interests, namely labor unions, who donate to think tanks like the Economic Policy Institute, another EPI. Though not as odious as Berman & Company, the Economic Policy Institute reliably publishes studies and surveys in favor of increases to the federal minimum wage, and those studies and surveys are reliably cited by activists with that policy goal. Unfortunately, the minimum wage has become a partisan issue. In his Vox article, Matthews points to a dispiriting paper by researchers from Columbia Business School that finds a robust correlation between patterns of academic writing and political behavior. If you know an economist's politics, in other words, you can predict their position on the minimum wage with unnerving accuracy. Partisanship like this makes people cynical and pessimistic. It's easy to question the trustworthiness of any expertise in a deeply polarized environment. In this case, however, I believe there are real experts to find, experts trying to produce actionable knowledge that policymakers can use. They may come to the problem with different assumptions about what governments should do for people or how drastic the inequality problem really is, and that can color the world in different ways. But I believe they're sincerely trying to show us an objective picture of what the data say. In Newmark and Dubé, I see honest experts with an honest disagreement. That's the problem. Putting my cards on the table, I'm a registered Democrat and believe the federal minimum wage should be increased. But can I say with certainty that this is the right thing to do? No, I can't. The best information I can gather on the question nudges me in one direction, but it isn't conclusive. Credible experts have divergent views. That's a stalemate I can't break. And as far as I can tell, neither can anyone else. Anybody speaking about this issue with complete conviction, from the President of the United States to your pal Gene from accounting, is either ignorant or dishonest. For the most part, I don't think the genes of the world are bad people. If there's one thing I've learned from researching this, it's that it is very easy to find yourself in self-reinforcing parts of the internet, where whatever you click on seems to support what you've just been reading. Partisan narratives can be very persuasive. Democrats often cite the shocking fact that when adjusted for inflation, the current minimum wage is actually lower than it was in 1968. That just feels morally wrong, in the same way that it feels morally right to disallow profitable corporations from paying their workers a pittance. On the other side, critics emphasize what everyone learns in Econ 101. Setting price floors upsets the equilibrium of the economy. If a wage is set above what the market dictates, demand for labor will decrease, resulting in higher unemployment. Studies showing that minimum wage hikes don't follow this basic law are naturally treated with suspicion. Democrats' advocacy for a higher minimum wage fits nicely into a narrative on the right that paints left-wing voters as wanting to have their cake and eat it too. Democrats, they think, like the idea of giving people more money, but fail to appreciate another fundamental rule of economics. There is no free lunch. This narrative isn't entirely unfounded, though Democrats are hardly the only party prone to oversimplifying. So what do I do? When experts disagree, how do I decide? In debate club, we're taught that the side seeking change, the affirmative case, has the burden of proof. The negative case, the status quo, enjoys presumption. Affirmative debaters have to persuade a reasonable audience that their position is correct. Negative debaters don't need to defend the status quo so much as rebut the narrative of the affirmative side. If they can prove that the affirmative argument is faulty or not entirely convincing, then they've done their job. The status quo wins out. This fits with a naturally cautious inclination in human beings. Trying something new always seems riskier than staying the course. The consequences of the latter might not be great, but at least they're known, while the consequences of the former are a bunch of big, scary question marks. The more I read about economics, however, the more I see this line of thinking used as a cudgel against new ideas. Every time the minimum wage rises to the top of the national conversation, resistance is swift and stinks of fear-mongering. At some point, the status quo becomes an affirmative case of its own, a case against any change. Decades pass with no significant update to policies designed for a world long gone. The status quo becomes more and more entrenched, and the issue gets stuck in the mud of partisanship. After a while, staying the course may become more risky than trying something different. As with climate science, there's a lot I don't know about economics, but I'm committed to learning more. It's every citizen's responsibility to be as informed as possible, And as someone fortunate enough to have a career devoted to learning new things, I have a greater responsibility than most. But I'll never be an expert on the minimum wage. I'll never be an economist or a climate scientist. In theory, I could pick one, maybe two specialties and commit my life to them. So could you. But that's not a practical solution to epistemic uncertainty. People have lives, jobs, families, bills. They have to take care of their aging parents, pick up groceries, do laundry, go to marriage counseling. The little leisure time they have, they deserve. If they want to play a pickup game of basketball on the weekend instead of reading a study about the downstream effects of the Affordable Care Act on socioeconomic disparities, who can blame them? I think there's time for personal lives and public responsibility, but there will never be enough time to escape our dependence on experts. That's a fact of life now, forever, and our dependency will only grow in the years to come as the world becomes even more complex. We may reach consensus on some debates, as we have in climate science. On other questions, experts will continue to disagree, and those questions will be on our ballots, too. Much as I'd like a satisfactory answer to the question that prompted this essay, that's not why I wrote it. I already know the answer, and it's unsatisfactory. When experts disagree, I can't decide. I wrote this essay to confront my limitations as a voter and to confess an ignorance I'm still coming to terms with. I've learned a lot in the last decade, but feel less sure than ever. It's bad timing. The world pleads for good people to stand behind their beliefs. The best lack all conviction, Yeats wrote in The Second Coming, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Those lines are usually interpreted as a comment on courage or the lack of it in times of fear and crisis. But what if the best lack conviction because conviction is impossible? What if the worst are the worst because they're passionately intense? I'm certainly not the best, and the people I hear in cafes who speak with certainty about the minimum wage or nuclear energy or foreign policy or trade or internet regulation are probably not the worst. But I've become deeply skeptical of conviction in recent years, and much quieter at dinner parties as a result, at least when politics comes up. That skepticism won't stop me from seeking conviction, but it won't stop the question from haunting me either. It's true what Einstein said. The more I learn, the more I realize how much I don't know. He's said to have said that anyway. We don't really know for sure. Escape into meaning. What in God's name drove me to watch The Lord of the Rings 50 times? It would be preposterous to watch any movie 50 times, but this is a trilogy, so it's triply preposterous, and each installment is more than 3 hours long. In the extended editions, which any fan of Peter Jackson's films will tell you are the only editions, that means I've spent something like 600 hours watching The Lord of the Rings, which is 25 days, or 3.5 weeks, almost a full month. Jesus, never did the math before. Footnote: the total runtime of the extended trilogy is 11 hours and 24 minutes. I rounded up a little in my calculation because, well, 50 viewings is probably an underestimate. Most of those hours occurred in college. One night, my friend Sam and I put on The Fellowship of the Ring in his dorm and were mesmerized. We'd both seen it in theaters, both read the books, but were genuinely shocked by how well it held up on second viewing. The following nights, we watched the remaining two films, then started from the top a week later and did it again. We decided, sort of as an experiment, to continue watching the movies until we got bored with them. expecting that to happen after a couple more times through the trilogy. A year later, we were still going. Maybe our love of the halfling's leaf clouded our minds, but the magic just wouldn't die. Sam and I shared an apartment sophomore year, and when we both had a free night, we'd throw on one of the extended edition DVDs, whichever suited the mood. Those films are so long that they're split into two discs, so after a long day of classes, one of us would yell into the hall, 1-2, or 3-1, first number for film, second for disc. I usually chose 1-1, Fellowship through the Council of Elrond. I'm a sucker for The Shire and anything with Ian Holm as Bilbo. Or 2-1, the first part of The Two Towers, which has the introduction of Rohan and my favorite scene in the trilogy, King Theoden mourning his son's passing, holding the symbol Muniflower. Ever has it grown on the tombs of my forebears. Now it shall cover the grave of my son. But I could be persuaded to watch any disc, given the right argument. Eventually, after far more rewatches than either of us anticipated, after Sam and I could perform the entire saga by heart, after Gandalf launched 1,000 fireworks and Boromir was pierced with 1,000 arrows, after 1,000,000 orcs sieged Helm's Deep and dozens of rings were cast back into the fiery chasms from whence they came, the thrill finally faded. For a while, anyway. Since that feverish year, I've revisited the movies periodically, a few times for Nerdwriter videos, but mostly as comfort food. A few months ago, during COVID lockdown, I watched the trilogy with my wife, who had never seen it before. It was like having fresh eyes. I tried not to be that guy who pauses the movie to say things like, "When Aragorn kicked that helmet, Viggo Mortensen actually broke his foot, but still managed to stay in character." My wife is not really a science fiction fantasy fan, so it was fun to see her get drawn into the story. Recently, I've taken to watching LOTR first reaction videos on YouTube, which are exactly what they sound like. Someone who's never seen the movies records themselves reacting to key moments. These kinds of videos have multiplied during the pandemic, earning hundreds of thousands of views. Guess I'm not the only Tolkien junkie trying to recapture the high of that first fix. It started with the films, but didn't end there. I've read the books a few times now, as well as The Silmarillion, Unfinished Tales, The Children of Húrin, and The Hobbit. I've pored through Tolkien's letters, read his essays, watched all the extant footage of him, listened to every radio interview. I've even written some LOTR fan poetry, a few verses that were mercifully lost when an old laptop died out of embarrassment. These things don't put me in the upper ranks of Tolkien superfandom. Just ask Stephen Colbert or the people who can actually speak Elvish. But I've spent a not insignificant amount of my life in the world he built. And it still pulls at me, still mesmerizes. It's appropriate to meet great art with great enthusiasm. But I think we can all agree that this is something else. As you heard in my essay about cyberpunk, I have a proclivity for certain kinds of escapist art. In Blade Runner and cyberpunk novels, I found an escape from the responsibilities of relationships, from the labels others place on us, and from the fragmenting pressures of modern culture in which individuals must fend for themselves in dizzying cross-currents of meaning. Cyberpunk is a space that affirms the essential meaninglessness of all things, a fantasy zone where it's no longer necessary to work at finding a place in the world. You're given permission to let go, to let the slipstream carry you where it will, through dazzling neon cityscapes pulsing with the music of Vangelis. I'm beginning to realize that Middle Earth serves an opposite function. If cyberpunk is an escape from meaning, a surrender to reality at its most nihilistic, then The Lord of the Rings is an escape into meaning, a longing for reality as I want it to be. If nothing has a purpose in The Sprawl, everything has a purpose in Middle Earth. Every person is circumscribed by their role in the mythology. There are prophecies, objects of sacred value, destinies, even for hobbits. As Gandalf tells Frodo in The Mines of Moria, Bilbo was meant to find the ring, in which case you were also meant to have it, and that is an encouraging thought. It would be encouraging to know that you were meant to do something, but unfortunately, I don't think that's the case in our world. I'm betraying my beliefs, so let me put them on the table. I don't think there is any objective purpose for humanity, or that there is a God of any kind. I don't believe people have destinies. I think everything that's happened since the Big Bang has happened by accident, following from physical laws that are inherently meaningless, like our lives. That's a bummer of a personal philosophy, I know. But I'm not denying all meaning, only the meaning that most religions believe comes from on high, the kind Gandalf sees in Frodo. What undoubtedly does exist is the meaning we give to things, personally and collectively. Subjective meanings can be as fulfilling as the ones people turn to God for, but you have to choose them, and the choosing can be hard. I'm not trying to change minds. I have no issue with believers. Often, I envy them. I see the appeal of divine purpose. Much as I pat myself on the back for a stoic refusal to succumb to magical thinking, I can't deny that something at the core of me longs for meaning with a capital M. It feels ancient, biological. For philosopher and author Albert Camus, this longing is the essence of the absurd, the existential conflict between beings who are disposed to look for the meaning of life and a universe that can't provide it. I first read Camus' essay, The Myth of Sisyphus, in my 20s, and it was like seeing a transcript of my thoughts. That nostalgia for unity, writes Camus, that appetite for the absolute illustrates the essential impulse of the human drama. The impulse for meaning is baked into us, and we can't rid ourselves of it, no matter how squarely we face the unreasonable silence of the world. According to Camus, all we can do is accept the absurdity of our situation, refuse false consolations like religion, and move on with the difficult but eventually rewarding work of making meaning for ourselves. Easier said than done. Our appetite for the absolute is always seeking outlets. The Lord of the Rings is one for me. Tolkien's mythology imagines a world in which there is a design to creation, in which supernatural things do happen. To the extent that the story is immersive, the reader can participate in this alternate universe, escape into its meanings, without having to believe something untrue. That's because the participation is literary, not actual. It's sort of like a loophole. In art, you can indulge in the consolations reason denies in life. Tolkien's Middle Earth is the ideal place for this kind of indulgence. It's impossible to imagine a more detailed secondary world, as he called it. The maps, the languages, the lineages, the lore. Middle Earth is a staggering feat of world building. Its density rewards exploration, enlivening every corner of the stories that take place there. That The Lord of the Rings does not suffer for Tolkien's fanatic landscaping is a testament to his skill as a storyteller, but that doesn't make it any less fanatical. Even before the movies visualized it, Middle-earth was a place you could see with perfect clarity. Here's Gimli's description of the glittering caves tucked behind Helm's Deep. Gems and crystals and veins of precious ore glint in the polished walls, and the light glows through folded marbles, shell-like, translucent as the living hands of Queen Galadriel. There are columns of white and saffron and dawn rose, Legolas, fluted and twisted into dreamlike forms. They spring up from many colored floors to meet the glistening pendants of the roof, wings, ropes, curtains fine as frozen clouds, spears, banners, pinnacles of suspended palaces. The brief depiction of these caves in the film is a pale rendering of Tolkien's prose. But that's not a knock on Peter Jackson. The movies did a stunning job of bringing Middle-earth to life, but no movie, no trilogy, not even one with a combined budget of $281 million, could approach the intricacy of Tolkien's vision. We're talking about an epic tale of good and evil in which the prologue contains an entire section about the varieties and customs of pipeweed in different regions of the Shire. Tolkien couldn't resist. He detailed his imaginary world with obsessive passion. But the obsession didn't start with Middle-earth. Believe it or not, that was a byproduct. For Tolkien, everything always started with language. Some teens experiment with drugs. Tolkien experimented with invented languages. His earliest was Animalic, a language fabricated by his cousins out of animal names. He was never fluent in it, but recalled to a prestigious literary society at Oxford that dog, nightingale, woodpecker, 40 meant you are an ass. Next came Nevbosh, also created by a cousin but more complex, then Naffarin, which was his own. Constructing new languages was Tolkien's secret vice, and even after he made the study of real languages his career as a philologist and professor of Anglo-Saxon at Oxford, he continued to do it, enchanted by the beauty of words. As his own languages grew more sophisticated, he realized that for the perfect construction of an art language, it is found necessary to construct, at least in outline, a mythology to go with it. Your language construction will breed a mythology. Maybe you can see where this is going. If not, here's an excerpt from a letter Tolkien wrote to the Houghton Mifflin Company after the publication of The Lord of the Rings, which drives the point home. The invention of languages is the foundation of The Lord of the Rings and other tales of Middle-earth. The stories were made rather to provide a world for the languages than the reverse. To me, a name comes first and the story follows. The Lord of the Rings is, to me anyway, largely an essay in linguistic aesthetic, as I sometimes say to people who ask me, what is it all about? If Middle-earth feels many times more solid than most fantasy worlds, this is why.